We're going to go ahead and get started. Representative Rood. Actually, Representative Rood has offered to move our wonderful minute from March 7th. Do you have a pen yet?
We don't even
have a pen. Lyle's here. I thought we had a pen. No, we don't. We're one short, so we have to wait. But I will take you up on that in just a little bit.
Can I work two hands?
Yes, we work, Representative Madore. But you'll give us your two hands. Members and those that are in the audience, I want to thank you for coming. And I'll probably say this again in just a little bit when we do get some more members. For the public that don't know, we do have several committees that are going on at the same time. And this is, while this is our usual time to meet with the Mental Health Committee, our deadlines, and we had stopped meeting a few weeks ago. But I did announce that we would have, you know, three or four more additional informational hearings that we wanted to make sure that we cover. And we tried our best not to do a Friday, but Session kept interfering with us, making sure that would happen. And so I want to thank you. We do have a couple testifiers today that do need to get out of here early, so we're going to try to move things forward. The premise of this is really, and you will get a chance to hear from a constituent of mine a little bit later, and I'll get into that in just a little bit, but we're going to start with the regular fetal alcohol syndrome that unfortunately we have not gotten rid of. And while the theory still is in a lot of people's minds that this is just a an American Indian issue, it is not. It is unfortunately still with us, and so hopefully we will get some factual information, and we're going to get started with Mrs. Carlson. And she is one of our folks that you fly out in an hour or so?
I have a flight at 1:30.
Well, we do thank you for squeezing us in.
Yeah, I understand. I can sit and do my...
Yes, you may.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you can identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Susan Carlson, and have many different titles. One that I carried graders was First Lady, and that was between 1991 and 1999. And which thing is here? I want to make sure that which one do I? Okay. And it was while I was First Lady that I became involved with the issue of fetal alcohol syndrome, and now we call fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And I just want to say thank you for having this hearing, because I became aware of this issue while I was doing a stint in juvenile court.
Mrs. Carlson?
Yes.
Can I get you to just either slide over just slightly to that mic? To make sure that we get you for the tape.
Okay. And I did that since in 1997. And as a result of that, a lot of things have happened since then. But I believe this is indeed a silent crisis. And it's less silent than it was back when I first got into it. But indeed, it affects more than Native Americans. It affects all socioeconomic groups. And what's so sad about it is that it's totally preventable. And what I'm going to do today is just give you a little bit of background on what fetal alcohol syndrome and the whole spectrum disorders is. We have some working knowledge so that you can understand how that impacts the topic that that you're talking about today, which is mental health considerations for those in the juvenile and criminal justice system. So, but I also believe that it's enormously expensive. And we know that just for fetal alcohol syndrome alone, it costs the state over $105 million in special ed, out-of-home placements, and that is an extremely conservative number. And fetal alcohol syndrome, folks, is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip, and we'll get into that. And if you look at this, you'll see where Minnesota is, and the darker states are the ones where women who are binge drinking, and that's four or more drinks. Minnesota, when I started this, was fourth, and Wisconsin was first. I think we're now seventh in the country with the highest percentage of women binge drinking. And binge drinking causes the most harm to the developing fetus. And so, and there are a lot of women who binge drink in Minnesota and don't intend to get pregnant that get pregnant. And so there's, it doesn't have to be a woman who's an alcoholic. It can be someone who goes out and parties during a time where she doesn't even know that she's pregnant. And this is how I got involved with the doing the detention calendar in Hennepin County District Court. And it was there that I saw the most at-risk kids in the system. They're kids that are running away from systems. They're in on a new serious offense. They're violating probation. And at that time, we had our child protection files and our delinquency files together. And what that allowed me to do was to draw a connection between the family's histories and the child that appeared before me. And it struck me that a lot of these kids that I saw came from families with huge substance abuse problems. And so we got involved back in 1997, and we did some funding, and then I felt that we needed to do a look to see where we were in the state, and I knew that Arnie was not going to run for re-election. We had a little bit of window of time that summer, and we did the Governor's Task Force on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. We still have a copy of that report. It's still valid today. And I've been working on the national level, developing Tools for Success, which is the resource guide for professionals in the juvenile justice system. And I created the Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome because there was none. There was no nonprofit in the state that dealt with this issue. But enough about me. Let's move on. Oops, I'm sorry. And this was the profile of the kids that I saw in the detention calendar. So you can see that a lot of them have diagnoses, various ADD, EDD, learning disabilities, lower IQs, come from families with these substance of problems. So this is what I saw. They did this study over a year's period of time. And I'm sure if you've had the opportunity to hear my husband speak, you would just, Alice in Wonderland, you would have heard this. And I think this is applicable to anything that you do in the legislature. And the way he would say it is, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And that's why we did the task force. And I just want to show you some of the findings. And basically, at that time, alcohol is our drug of choice in Minnesota. And it's pervasive all over the state. We had 9 public hearings, and there's a general lack of knowledge about it in our systems. When I say systems, I say school systems, I say correctional, juvenile systems, and it occurs in families generation after generation. And we see that in Hennepin County. We see the same families over and over again. And the vast majority of these folks are not identified. And they do better when they are identified. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read this book, but this came out around the same time that I was going through this. And many experts believe that fetal alcohol exposure, because it's both undetected and untreated, well, it could be the single largest factor setting up the conditions to predispose our children to get into trouble with the law. And I would highly recommend this book. And then people will say, well, Susan, you can't tell me that fetal alcohol is causing all of these children to get into trouble with the law. What I'm saying is, political science have looked at all sorts of different factors for why people get into trouble with the law. And we've looked at mental health screenings. We've looked at poverty. We've looked at chemical dependency. We've looked at the environment. But for some reason, fetal alcohol has been kind of left out of the picture. And so to me, I look at it as a missing piece of the puzzle that we need to bring in, because once we know that, then we can, it's like any disability. Once you know what you're dealing with, then you can provide better intervention. So why isn't it on our radar screen? Well, obviously it's a legal drug, and we don't know. We can't say for certain that they stem from the prenatal exposure. We don't want to label children, although we label children all the time with other labels like EBDs, which tells a child they have behavior problems or they are conduct problems. And if we diagnose it, we don't know, we have to treat it, and we don't have the resources to do that. And I think the shaming the mother is, we don't want to say that mothers do this to their children. And just, I think it's important that people understand that, and I said that earlier, that a lot of this happens because women don't even know that they're pregnant. You have chemical dependency, which is an addiction, and there have been many studies that women cannot, because of that addiction, stop drinking, even when they're pregnant. And the systems currently are not geared to identifying children. In special ed, in the juvenile justice system, and other systems. So do we know how many there are? This is our pink elephant in the room. And that's the $64,000 question. And if you just look at those, you know, I don't want to bore you with a lot of statistics, but those are the ones I think there's a belief among a lot of people that work in the system that they're vastly overrepresented in the child protection and juvenile criminal justice system. But there have never been any incident studies of this population. But if you look at how many children we have in the foster care system, and you know, how many women are continuing to drink heavily during pregnancy and how many are exposed, I think it's significant. And to me, it's all about drawing linkages and connections. I found that cartoon and I thought that had a good message about connections and linkages. And these are the connections and linkages that I'm talking about. And if you look at child welfare, 40 to 80% of those cases show substance abuse is present. And we know if you bring any judge in here that is that deals with child protection, you know that substance abuse and multiple, either drugs or alcohol. And so we know that is in the child protection system. And we know there's a link between those that have been prenatally exposed to becoming abused and neglected, because they are more difficult children. It's a difficult environment. And so more children that are prenatally exposed become our abused and neglected children. And then there's been lots of studies about the link between those that are in the child protection system that end up in our juvenile justice and criminal justice system. And we did a study of Hennepin County youth in Red Wing several years ago, and it was going to be to try to figure out how many of those had a fetal alcohol. We found out that 90% of those youth, of those 67 youth, had been in the child protection system, but unfortunately they exited the system before we were able to get them a diagnosis. So we don't know how many of them had fetal alcohol. But just in summary, I think there is substantial evidence, but we have no U.S. study on the incident. British Columbia in Canada did one youth that were sent for intake and psyche valves, and out of that study, it was 25% that came in for intake and psyche valves that had something within the spectrum. And Washington State did a foster care screen, and it was 10% greater incidence in the foster care system. So, what are we talking about? What is FASD? It's permanent birth defect. And it results directly from prenatal exposure. And it causes physical, behavioral, and emotional disabilities that last a lifetime. and it can vary by dose, timing, and pattern of a woman's drinking. Now, I just returned from a national conference, and we've learned a lot of this from animal studies. And one of the things that I learned, because people say, well, my mother drank, and, you know, I'm not fetal alcohol. It can depend on genetics. If you have a stronger gene, it can depend on nutrition. It can depend on whether the woman is iron deficient. In fact, they're finding that women that are iron deficient and drink is the most deadly combination. If they're iron deficient, it can also cause harm. But if you combine the two, that's really deadly. And so, and it's, what we're primarily concerned with, obviously, is the brain. And that's the one that causes the most harm. And it's been given lots of labels, and we've heard fetal alcohol effects. You don't see anything physically. There's nothing physically you see. It's all in the brain. And there's been over 30 years of research. You would think with this type of what we call, it's a teratogen. It's something that damages the brain in utero. That we would know more what to do with it, and we would do something about stopping it. This is how I look at the spectrum. Fetal alcohol syndrome is a small piece of the spectrum, and the rest of it is much larger. And the reason that is because, we'll go back to that, is because you have to have, well, there's another slide here in a minute, but let's just talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It's not a diagnostic term. You do not diagnose people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And I was part of this group that developed this statement out in Washington. We finally got people together because we had all these acronyms for various things. And we sat down, got all the experts together. Hey, what are we going to call this? It's like an autism. What are we going to call it? So we sat around and we got the CDC and various people who were interested in the subject, and we came up with a statement on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So it's this whole other where they don't have the characteristics of fetal alcohol syndrome. Fetal alcohol syndrome requires all of these. You have certain facial features. You have growth and weight deficiencies, and you have central system dysfunction, which is the brain. You have to have all of those to have a diagnosis. And to have the facial, and these are the classic facial features, the ones on the left are the ones that they find most often. Those are developed during the first 3 weeks of pregnancy. So if a woman does not have alcohol during that 18-hour window, those facial features are not going to be developed. And so they're not going to have the small eyes. They're not going to have the indistinct filter or a thin upper lip. And so when people say fetal alcohol syndrome, they have to have these facial features. And there's a medical diagnosis, and they can be diagnosed with that. And since we're talking about the brain, I wanted to show you pictures of the brain. And the ones on the left are normal, and the ones on the right, obviously, are not. And that is an extreme case. Not everyone that has damage to the brain are going to have all those holes. But that's what happens when alcohol goes into the brain. It causes the connections to not go where they're supposed to go. It creates holes. It's been described like having Swiss cheese for your brain, so there's you just don't have those connections. And here's what we've learned from animal research. And what's good about animal research is you can control the conditions. You know, because people say, well, how do you know all this stuff? It's because they've been doing all these animal research. Alcohol itself causes these birth defects. And they can filter out where the animal, you know, they didn't have any cocaine. You can filter out the environment. You can filter out all those other things. And they can study these animals, and they can put them through various tests to test how their cognitive skills are. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. And they have found that there can be they've done chickens where the chickens look absolutely normal. They give them enough alcohol to ding up their brain, and they look absolutely normal on the outside, but they can't perform the same kind of tasks that other animals do that don't have the alcohol. And this Dr. David Smith was one of the doctors that diagnosed the first child with fetal alcohol syndrome. And I thought that it seems like we get hung up on fetal alcohol syndrome, that he said way back in 1981, we need to talk about the greatest concern is the effects on the brain and its development and not on the face. And this is what I would say is a behavioral profile of someone within the spectrum. Not all people with fetal alcohol are alike, just like not all children with autism are alike. But something has happened to their brain and it affects their brain. Connections are broken like a stroke. It affects their ability to reason and think, and they tend to be more black and white thinkers. Highly impulsive. They're not good with math. They cannot learn from their mistakes. Like, I had a child in my courtroom. Why did you take the bike? Well, it was there and I needed a ride home. No concept that it wasn't his. I mean, he couldn't take it. And so when you get into the whole concept of, you know, them in the courtroom, it's really important to understand what were they thinking? What was their intention? If they don't have that ability to make that, then it really gets the whole system of our justice and fairness. And I think this last one gets to the whole issue why we're here today, and that's about having children that go into the adult system. They function at a level much younger than their age. And now I must say, on a personal level, I have never had a child with fetal alcohol syndrome, but I have a brother who has a brain tumor, and it's in the front lobe. And actually, he's doing very well now. But at the time, it was kind of the same thing. He was very impulsive. It was right by his corpus callosum, and so my sister-in-law had to lock the refrigerator. He would eat everything in there. He would watch TV and he'd watch all the porn channels. I mean, he never did any of this stuff before the brain tumor. But in effect, he says he's like a child. I can't control him. Now he's back to work. He's an adult and he's doing fine. So would we have had him sign a contract? Absolutely not. Would we have let him drive a car? There's all sorts of things. His brain was affected. And I think if you can't remember anything else from this presentation, look at this chart, because it does tell you physically they look like an 18-year-old. They can even actually talk above that, a 20-year-old. But their comprehension is more like a 6-year-old. Money and time is like an 8-year-old. And so you really need to look at who is this person. And there are tests, obviously, that can tell us those kinds of things. So what do we know about these people and getting into trouble with the law? And there's lots of studies that talk about what predisposes young people for getting into trouble with the law. And this is what struck me when I first got into this. ADHD, impulsivity, learning disability are all predators for being delinquent in criminal behavior. Poor judgment, inability to understand cause and effect, failure in school. All of these contribute. And if you look at this, it's just very interesting that a lot of people that have the disability of fetal alcohol are remarkably similar to these kinds of groups. Coincidence? I think it's more than a coincidence. Dr. Ann Strice, I call her the mother of fetal alcohol. She was part of the team that diagnosed first fetal alcohol baby back in 1973. And she did it, and I've gotten to know her very well. And she had the wisdom to study a group of individuals, 415 over a period of time. And it's her secondary disability study. And she has brought so much information to do that. I said, why did you do it? She said, well, I was curious as to how, you know, what happens to these folks over time. And, how do I go back? Anyway, primary disability is the disability, that's okay, Jennifer, I can verbalize it, you guys don't have to read it. Primary disability is the disability in the brain. Secondary disability is what happens because of that. Getting into trouble with the law, failure in school. And so she looked at what happened to these people over time. And if you look at the chart, mental health problems is at the greatest. 90% they all did the mental health treatment with little success. 60% got into trouble with the law. 60% sold depression. So the statistics for these folks were not good. If you want more information on our study, I think she has given more to the field. So these were her key findings with people that got into trouble with the law. Crimes against the person were most good ones. Chaplaincy was their first crime. That gets from the impulsivity. They see something they want it, they take it. They don't think about it. And then combination of school, drug, and alcohol problems got them in. That was a big correlation, got them into problems. Protective factor was if they had a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, which gave them an IQ of 70, or if they had an IQ of 70 or less, and they got DD services. 70 and above, increased risk. That's counterintuitive. Why would somebody with a higher IQ get more in trouble with the law? It's because they were recognized and they got services. That's where they were more likely to get the services and not get into trouble with the law. 70 or above, you think that they look fine, they're just bad kids or bad people, so they're getting in trouble with the law. These are the protective factors he found. And I think they're, if you look at them, probably protective factors for any people that, or any kind of disability. If you get an early diagnosis and you don't have that violence against yourself, but that's a double whammy. And that's why the kids in the child protection system, I think, really, they've got the damage to the brain as well as the physical and the abuse and neglect afterwards. And if you were to do some studies in prisons, I'm sure you'd find a big correlation with that. And I'm going to do this very quickly because we have other speakers. I want to give them the opportunity. These are the issues that I see, identification issues in our system. Our systems are not geared to identifying these folks. When I started this, many psych assessments never dealt with questioning whether a child is prenatally exposed. They're doing it now more and more often. They've dealt with maybe any brain injuries after birth, but they did not, and professionals do not routinely provide court histories of prenatal alcohol exposure history. So, Head of County was fortunate, and I'm going into the next part of the agenda, to get the federal funding a couple of years ago to do some screening in our juvenile justice system. And I was part of that. And unfortunately, you know, with government being a part of it, that sometimes this was supposed to be a 5-year funding, and they ended it because of a contract dispute with SAMHSA and Northrop Grumman. But anyway, we did it for a period of a year. We did screening interviews in the juvenile justice system. But good news is we have this funding back, and we're going to start screening again. And we were one of only two. We're only one of two systems in the country. The other one is in Colorado. That's going to be screening delinquent children. I'm very proud of that. And they want to make sure that what we do, that we do in a small model so that it can be replicated. So they don't want us to do an incident where we try to screen all the kids and try to figure out how many we have. The ones we screen, they want to make sure that what we do it right. Because getting a diagnosis without doing the right thing is almost worse than getting the diagnosis. And this is the importance that I see in that subcontract. Because it does, we screen them, and I know there'll be questions on how we do that, and I don't know if we want to go into all that, but we want to develop approaches that we can sustain and that can be replicated in other systems around the country. This was the result of our first initiative. We screened 606 juveniles. The kids that we screened went through the Project Support Mental Health Clinic, and 20%. And I would say that's probably a conservative number because a lot of the biological parents that come through, a lot of bio moms, it's difficult for them to admit it. Even when we would say, when did you know you were pregnant, and try to, we don't want to assign blame to it because we feel that we want to move beyond that. Out of those that came positive, 58% received full FASD evaluation. And that was because you had families moving away, you had ones that didn't cooperate. That's why you have a call-off. So that's why not all got an evaluation. But 80% of those that went over there got a diagnosis. And they got a diagnosis. You mostly either got a diagnosis of partial FAS, so they didn't have all the facial features, or they didn't have the growth deficiency. But they had some part. So they had a partial FAS, or they had what we call ARND, where they didn't have any of the facial. And the diagnosis is, they go through a neuropsych test, and there's brain domains, and so it's very scientific how they come up with that there is brain dysfunction. There are lots of issues that I think face the juvenile criminal court, and you're dealing with one of them, which is certification for adult court. But I see their confessions. There are many cases of people with fetal alcohol confessing the things that they don't do because they want to plead, and whether they're actually competent to even understand what's going on in the system. But so, and sentencing, there's just a myriad of issues. And I know that there are some other people here that are going to talk about certification, so I just wanted to, this is what the court looks at. And as referee, I'm not part of making this decision, so this is a Supreme Court decision that lays down the factors as to what the court needs to look at to certify. And if you look down, you look at the sophistication and maturity of a juvenile. And if you think about a youth with fetal alcohol, and you go back and you look at that chart and how they might be physically mature, but they have, the mental capacity, social understanding capacity of a six-year-old. Youth with FASD are more likely to commit serious offenses and are at greater risk for adult certification because they tend to have a lengthy history of offenses, failed probation, failed community services, and they may appear to lack remorse. And I believe that it has serious implications for these youth. Again, these are the implications. I think that they are at greater risk for exploitation once they're in the adult system, in a prison system. They learn modeling behavior. So you're going to create a criminal if you send these youth into the adult system, into the prison system, because they're going to learn the criminal ways if they don't. They're going to model that. So I think it's something that really needs to be looked at. Summary and conclusion, and I think I'm over a little bit on my time. It's the pink elephant, folks. It's the pink elephant. And it's getting less pink, maybe a little more red. But I think the lack of awareness and understanding creates the secondary disabilities that we're talking about. School, law, chemical, mental health problems. And I believe it's a huge drain, frankly, on our public education. And finally, I think that we, and that includes all of you, when we intervene in the lives of families, I think that it carries a special burden that we have to act productively. So I thank you very much for your attention. And I know I did it very quickly, and we've got a lot of other people that want to testify.
Mrs. Carlson, if you could just hold on before we get to questions and let Mr. Johnson testify, because you both have to leave about the same time.
Okay.
I'd appreciate that. Members, I just didn't interrupt Mrs. Carlson. We had an official quorum about 10,
okay.
15. I just didn't want to stop the train of thought. And Representative Bryling wanted me to apologize on her behalf. She has two speaking engagements, so she had to leave us. And Representative Paymar and Representative Anderson are in the Finance Committee with interest, and Representative Cohen has a bill up in Finance, so he was hoping to get back down here. And Representative Cornish from Public Safety, who has an interest in this, is also in Finance. This chatty committee going on upstairs. Always so chatty. Mr. Johnson, thank you for joining us. If you can identify yourself for the tape, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Johnson. I am the Washington County Attorney, and I am also the co-chair of the Juvenile Committee of the Minnesota County Attorney Association. I have also been the Wadena County Attorney, so I have a pretty good idea of what happens in outstate as well as in the metro area. And I've been asked today to give you a brief synopsis as to what happens in a certification matter. And what we're handing out now is the juvenile rule concerning certification. It's identical to the statute. There is a presumption of certification when you have a child who's 16 or 17 and that person has committed a crime that is going to be above the line on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, guidelines, and therefore it's a presumed that they're going to prison. That presumption is rebuttable, and what happens in the case is that the judge will order a psychological evaluation, a social history, a family history, lots of reports. The judge is to take into consideration the primary concern of public safety. And there are six considerations that the judge considers at the time of the certification hearing. And those considerations are also considered in the psychological and in the family history. The idea of certification is for public safety. Number one, for us old timers, we remember the pre-David Brom case where we were to look at public safety versus the best interest of the child. And then in Rochester, they had a kid at age 15, I believe, who axe murdered his entire family. And a decision was made by this legislature to make public safety the primary concern. I agree what has been said about the fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. We had one juvenile who, in fact, was diagnosed with it, with a very violent crime. We moved to certify him. What happened was that in the psychological and in the home study, that fetal alcohol syndrome came out. It was considered by the court, and the court did not certify him. We ended up sending him to Utah for treatment. Was justice served? Absolutely. It's my belief that the juvenile system is one that is to look at each individual juvenile. And that's what we do when we move for certification. We do not put kids into pockets. We look at each individual case, and that is why we have those studies. I've had a number of cases when I was doing juvenile work where we would have a kid who did an extremely violent act, has had no previous criminal behavior. And I moved to certify that kid, not because I wanted to certify him and send him to prison, but I wanted to know what was going on with that kid before we made the decision as to how to treat him. And in most of those cases, it came back, do not certify, and I'm fine with this. I'm a firm believer in the juvenile justice system. We treat kids. We do not warehouse them as the criminal justice system does. But there are going to be cases with kids with fetal alcohol syndrome who are not going to be able to be handled by the juvenile system. And we have to have the flexibility to work with each kid as an individual. And I would remind the committee that we do not certify kids for property crimes. We do not certify kids for crimes against persons which are misdemeanors. We certify them for the absolute most dangerous crimes against public safety in Minnesota. The murders and the assaults that are felonies. But you've got to give us and let us continue with the flexibility that we now have. If there's one thing I would ask this committee to do, and it's this. Give us more resources to deal with the mentally ill kids. A few weeks ago, I was here in this building testifying against an attempt to move the age of certification to 13. I'm against it. The County Attorneys Association is against it. And we made a policy position paper on it. And let me read from that position paper my conclusion. Finally, as practitioners, we notice all too often the overwhelming mental health issues facing troubled youth in our community. With sufficient resources for diagnosis, treatment, and general mental health services are in short supply. Therefore, we strongly support options that would increase these services to those juveniles who need it most. We're talking about those kids. If you don't want those kids certified, then give us the resources to treat them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Are there any questions that members may have? For either one of our testifiers, I should say. I have a question myself. If no one else, Representative, do you have questions? Okay, that's fine.
So Mrs. Carlson, I just want to thank both of you for your testimony. A couple of years ago, I had the honor of attending some of the hearings, or I guess I'm not sure what we would call them, that a bunch of us got together up in Brooklyn Center and for the commission studying the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And I really appreciate your leadership in this area. It is really difficult to counsel pregnant women and hear them say, you know, I read a book and they said a glass of wine once in a while is okay. And, it's, you know, we really we have our work cut out for us. Sorry, you guys, I didn't have enough coffee this morning. I had insomnia last night. But, you know, one of the lines I always tell them is, you know, we know a lot of drinking is bad, but we don't know is the minimum amount and when in the gestation, you know, how little it takes to cause the damage. We don't know that lower spectrum, so we really have a zero tolerance as far as alcohol consumption and pregnancy is what how we try to educate our patients. But it's really difficult to look at a young woman who herself is a victim of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. It's just very sad to see this preventable disorder. So thank you for your leadership on that.
Thank you. And I must say that we are learning more about moderate alcohol use and how and its impacts on the fetus. At that same national conference, there's some animal studies being done in Wisconsin, and they've been looking at apes, and they're showing that moderate amounts, and they're talking maybe two drinks. You could divide it, like a glass of wine would be 4 ounces, so that'd be two glasses of wine a day would cause damage to the brain and cause central nervous system. So, there's studies about maybe a connection between that and autism, and there's a lot we're learning every day. So,
Representative Rood, you know, that zero tolerance I think is so important, besides the fact that we don't know that minimum base, but, you know, those of us that are on Health and Human Services know I talk about my asthma quite a bit, and the fact that we could be within one family and our body chemistry is complete, can be similar but different than our brother. And so I could be more predisposed to asthma and my other brother can be more predisposed to high blood pressure. And so we don't know how individuals will impact even just having a glass a day or just that first month and not knowing. It can impact us completely different. Representative Madour.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mrs. Carlson, I'm on the Public Health Committee, and of course we had the news came in that this program was one that the governor wanted to cancel, our fetal alcohol public education, public health program. And what I'm wondering is I'm trying to think back. I don't remember during my pregnancies I was asked about alcohol consumption. Both my pregnancies were planned, so I knew when I was pregnant. And but I'm also remembering, I don't remember seeing a lot of posters and things like that. So can you take just a minute to give us some ideas of what is up in the doctor's offices? I know I see some in establishment restaurants that say one drink a day that show a pregnant woman, but I don't remember seeing a lot of that in my doctor's offices. So are there pamphlets that are created as part of that program, or what's the educational pieces for the fetal alcohol education plan?
Mrs. Carlson?
The current plan, obviously through the Department of Health, they've always had that it's your safest choice not to. There's in restrooms, you know, you go in there, and we had a campaign last year, billboards. But I think the bigger issue is educating the doctors and the nurses to ask the questions, because you can put all the brochures and papers that you want, but if you don't have the buy-in of the doctors, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard pregnant women where their doctor has told them, well, you can have a glass of wine here or there. So it's, you know, public awareness, obviously. I would love to treat this like we've done with Matt did with drinking and driving. If we could raise the level to that, and, you know, I don't want to scare everybody and say, well, if a woman has one glass of wine, she's going to have a child with fetal alcohol. But if we could take this issue as seriously as we have drinking and driving, I think we would make a huge headway.
Representative Burnett.
Representative Mulder.
Just one quick thought. Thank you, Representative Burnett. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that raises my next question then. What have the alcohol, like the beer companies, I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. That's how much of a drink I am. What have they done? I mean, I know they're very vocal here at the Capitol about their wine in the grocery store and that sort of thing, but what have these organizations done to try to combat this issue? You know, for cigarettes, we have the warning on the pack. I don't see anything in the liquor store that is talking about it.
Well, there are signs in the liquor store, and there are warnings on.
We all read
wine.
Those labels, Mrs. Carlson.
Right?
Well, we all read the label right before we take a swig.
And I know this is not popular amongst when we talk about fees and taxes around the legislature, but it seems to me that we haven't raised the tax on alcohol since 1988, and a nickel a drink would bring in a little over $100 million and would go a long way in doing a lot of the things that Mr. Johnson's talking about and what we need in the schools, what we need to deal, you know, systematically with this issue. And I think, and it might even decrease the use of alcohol. And I think if you, and maybe Mr. Johnson could agree with me on this, that if you got rid of the issue of chemical dependency in our system, you'd put us all out of business.
Mm-hmm. Representative Clark would say thank you for her promo on her bill. Representative Reinhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, you had pointed to just in your last comment about schools, but Representative Medora's line of questioning led me to think about what work is being done to integrate some of these issues into health curriculums, because that seems to me to be the starting point long before the doctor or sexually active young women having this information part of our health culture.
And MOFAS, the organization that is the fiscal agent of most of the state money, is working on that, and I don't know if our executive director wants to give you any more details on that, but working on curriculums with nurses and doctors, and hopefully get through the university online. I mean, one thing about this issue, once you get into it, and I thought maybe 10 years later I would not be still involved in it, but it's just like there's just too much to do that, you know, I could work on this until I'm 150 and not complete it. But I don't know if there is anything specifically that you want to add to that. This is Sarah Messel. She's the executive director of the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome.
Yeah, just real briefly, one of the big initiatives that we're working on right now with our collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health is a continuing medical education program with the University of Minnesota that is available online. We have an extensive professional education committee because I think exactly what you're saying is true. We need to have physicians and nurses and all providers giving the same message that we don't know how much is safe, so it's best to avoid during pregnancy. We know from studies that trusted family members, moms, sisters, dads, and the physicians are the most powerful voice in terms of a woman's the choices that a woman makes during pregnancy. So we really are working hard to educate both of those groups.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this question is partly for you, but I'm thinking K-12. I'm not thinking university level. I'm thinking health education when we, you know, not just maybe attached to sex education, but overall health education on substance abuse and, you know, but that this, if we publicly own this information at a much broader level, you've already sort of set the scene for that one-to-one awareness that goes on with the doctor or the nurse. But if we don't have that in the background, I think we're losing out on an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barnhart, good point. Actually, I wouldn't mind working on an amendment with you, and then,
you know, why not? But and then also, Representative Reiling, I know we can have a follow-up conversation with her and Representative Mayai moving forward and what we should be doing through Representative McFarland.
Yes, Madam Chair, I thank you very much for your presentation. I'm concerned about what happens after they've gone into adulthood. Where do they go? Where do they go from foster care or the criminal system? And then secondly, because these people make poor decisions, what happens when they become parents?
Mrs. Carlton or Mr. Johnson?
I think that's a very good question. And it's something that a lot of parents, particularly adoptive and foster parents, and you're going to hear from some of them, struggle with on a daily basis. And frankly, that's one of the things. I'm going to be retiring from the bench in a couple of weeks because, to be honest, I'm an individual that I'm not going to call myself a victim, but as a result of budget cuts and my position is being eliminated. And so people come to me and they say, well, if they can cut you, they can cut anyone. But I was going to retire anyway, so I'm not upset about it because it gives me the opportunity to get into those kinds of that realm, because those people, they become parents, then we have our next generation, and they need to have protected payees, they need to have social security eligibility, they need to have structured environments. There's all sorts of things that they need that they don't get otherwise. They become a part of our criminal justice system, and we know that it's now 1 in 100, which ironically is the same number that is quoted for the number of people that the incidence of FASD is 1 out of 100. I'm not going to say there's any connection, but anyway, that's a huge, huge issue. And I hope that some of the parents that we have here can talk about that.
Representative Otumba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I used to be a family and consumer scientist teacher, and I always did the sex education in the sexual education, but we also included the alcohol and a lot of other things, and we and actually pulled in parents. But we've barely got any family and consumer science teachers or even places in our junior high or senior high. So I think that's a big problem because we know there's some research out there even with men, and it's not just men and women that need to be washing with their eating, whatever, from it, when it comes to, and I'm sure you've heard those resource pieces, so we have to include a, but how do we do that? We've taken a lot of that away.
Well, and then you look at DARE. DARE does not talk about this. So there's, and I don't know, you know, how, there's so many issues having to do with this, and that's why we did the Governor's Task Force, but it might be, you know, that was in 1997. It might be well worth the legislature's time to revisit this and to come up with a strategic plan. Go back to my Alice in Wonderland cartoon. If you don't know where you're going, any road gets you there. And there's lots of pieces, but perhaps the state needs a strategic plan on how we can best deal with this whole, all of these issues, and do a nickel a drink to fund it.
Member, I'm going to do a, I started with the self-disclosure when we started the committee meeting. You know, I do have a constituent that's going to be testifying in a little bit, and so I won't get into his story. But one of the reasons why I wanted to do this hearing, and, you know, it's a weird combination for some folks are like, what are we doing? And listening to him and finding out more about his story, it intrigued me how much information we're not getting about FASD here as members. And although we're not able to quantify the cost to state government, the numbers are quite high, in my opinion. And then the other part to it, I was very interested in utilizing my constituent's story with his son, but it made me go further. What happens to our young, our juveniles who are certified regardless? You know, we know once they're convicted and they go to St. Cloud, they're shipped separate and then geared after the 21, that, you know, mainstreams with the adult population. But within our jail system across the state, if you're certified as an adult, our jails don't have the capacity to keep young people separate from adults. And then to add on to that, if you have been diagnosed or not been diagnosed and you've been certified as a juvenile, as an adult, what is happening to our young, and then, you know, what type of services are being followed up. I mean, one of the unfortunate parts, although we do have a system that we do have to have because we do have to have consequences, unfortunately, we haven't made a commitment as a legislative body to spend more money on prevention to prevent some of these things. But, you know, we don't want to get our young who have already been, in most cases, part of the child protection system, most cases maybe been and started with chemical dependency early themselves or coming from a CD family themselves, and then putting them in a system where it's going to be easy for them to learn some things that they didn't know before, and then get back out and recommit at a higher level. And so I'm really interested if you guys have some suggestions on, you know, I know it's money that's needed. Mr. Johnson, you were very clear, and I agree with you. We need some more money coming in. But other ideas that could be helpful moving forward, what could we be doing with our juveniles, especially those that are certified with FASD or any other mental health disorder within our jail system across the state? Mrs. Carlson or Mr. Johnson?
My only comment on that knowledge, I've taken up a lot of time, is education, obviously, of those in the prison system so they understand the disability. And that's been shown by studies that they've done out in the state of Washington that Dr. Freskos did. They educated prison guards about the disability, and it helped. The infractions were down. They weren't put into situations where they could be violated. And so there were certain things that they were able to do within the prison system itself that made it not as negative an experience as it could have been for those individuals.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
My experience is that the kids that we certify don't go to jails, they go to prison. I think the vast majority are that way. Now, you're going to have some people under that might be the exception, but the other problem you have, especially when you get outstate, is that with the smaller jails, they are not going to be in a position to be able to segregate them very well. I think it's a problem. I agree with you. It's a problem. And I don't have a solution. The only solution I can see is prevention right at the start. Unfortunately, it's a little late.
Mr. Johnson, is the association, I'm assuming this isn't something new, has the association been talking about it or trying to figure out any, I mean, getting behind some prevention dollars? I do thank you for coming to testify against moving certification to 13. But it just seems like we're just, I don't know, I don't want to say missing the ball, but letting the train get ahead of us way too fast. I guess that's the point. And unfortunately, we do have more young people, whether they are diagnosed with something or not, that are committing more aggressive and aggravated assault and murders on people. Unfortunately, that's our society as a whole, but I'm interested in knowing, you guys, can you work on something and come back to the legislature?
You know, I've been worried about this since they first came out with this syndrome and disorder. I think you could see this coming down the track like a train just about to hit us, and it's hit us now. And what's frustrating for me is, as I said, I'm a firm believer in the juvenile system. People have asked me, how come you never got into the adult system? I said, because we don't change behavior. The juvenile system changes behavior. But when you've got these mental disorders, it is so much harder to change the behavior. Like I said, we had a young juvenile who committed a very violent act with a knife, attacked a girl in her bedroom and gave her permanent damage. And we kept him, we EJJ'd him, so he was in the juvenile system. And we had to send him out to Utah to get him treatment. And I don't even know how good that treatment was. But that's what we had to do.
I do want to end this with a positive story, because I believe there is hope. And that's why I've stayed in this for so long. We had one young man that, when we first started doing our screening, and I had taken a year's leave from the bench, and I was part of the out-of-home screening committee, and his probation officer came into that committee, and he said, I am at my wit's end. This is the most difficult youth that I've had to deal with, and we don't know what to do with him. He's just been in every place that I can think of, and his behavior is just, you know, off the wall, and we can't figure out what to do with him. And so I said, well, do you know if there was any prenatal exposure? And he said, I will ask mother. And he did. This was a biracial kid. And came back, and she admitted. So we screened him. We had him evaluated at the University of Minnesota. He got a diagnosis of partial fetal alcohol syndrome. His in-home family therapist had attended a two-day training with Diane Melvin, who knows this issue inside and out and what we need to do for intervention. He was sent to a group home up in northern Minnesota that had gotten a lot of training on fetal alcohol, and this was a high-functioning kid. His IQ was 116, but had a lot of anger built up, a lot of frustration, I think, because of his disability. He could have been thrown out of that group home if he'd been treated like others. But they understood his disability. He was able to get his GED and scored high in the 90%. He got his GED. He had a couple of jobs. This was a throwaway kid. He would have ended up in prison. He was our success story.
Thank you for that. And thank you both for taking the time this morning and coming to share.
Thank you.
Miss McNaughton? Did I do that right?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Lisa McNaughton, and I am the managing attorney of the Juvenile Court Division of the Public Defender's Office. I learned of this hearing earlier this week and was asked to come and give a few comments about certification, mental health, and FASD. I believe it was about 13 or 14 years ago where I walked into an arraignment courtroom and met a young man who, luckily for him and for me, I had read something about FASD, but not much. But when I met this young man and looked at what his case was about and talked to him about the allegations in the case, I immediately was worried about his level of competence. He clearly had some physical features which looked to me to be possible FASD related. And his behaviors were very unusual. What he was accused of doing was going into a neighbor's home and standing in her kitchen. He liked her a lot. He wanted to be friends with her. And she was very, very scared about this young man who was 17 years old at the time and standing in her home. And the first time she was patient, but about the third or fourth time the police were called. And what we did with this young man was did a competency evaluation to determine whether he was in fact able to assist in his defense and whether he was able to participate in the system. He was not. And given his level of incompetence, a child protection case opened up, and he was given appropriate services throughout that system. He was not adjudicated delinquent. He was able to have some assistance with a social worker while he was still in juvenile court, and then was able to get into the DD services as an adult, where he proceeded to move into a group home setting and get the help he needed. That was not the most usual situation. Most of the kids that we see don't necessarily have the facial features. We staff in all systems might not necessarily know what to look for with children with FASD. But frankly, it's broader than that. It goes back to all the issues we're dealing with and our knowledge now about adolescent brain development. And I'm not certain how many people have seen the decision that the United States Supreme Court did in United States versus Roper, but that decision informed us very well about the major differences between the brain of a child and the brain of an adult. And the Roper court was basically regarding an 18-year-old child and whether that child could be executed, but the case went further than that and talked about the major differences between the juvenile brain and the adult brain. And when the Roper decision came out, they basically talked about the developmental differences. We had the psychological association. We had doctors testifying on behalf of the kids, just about the massive differences between kids and adults and where the development is and at what point is the brain fully functioned and developed, and frankly, it's somewhere between 21 and 25 years old. So I really appreciate Mr. Johnson's comments that we can't go backwards and talk about 13-year-olds getting into an adult system. What we have to do is have better services for kids as they get older. In the early 90s, we started seeing all of these legislative proposals that kids were super predators, that they were the worst kids in the world, and we have to protect ourselves from these children. While at the same time, violent crime has been going down regularly since that process. And so what are the issues from our perspective? Well, one of them is looking at the handout that Mr. Johnson passed out to you, which talks about the public safety factors that the court must look at. When we're dealing with whether a child should be certified, EJJ, or straight juvenile, we are all dealing with these factors. We have a court psychologist looking at the kids, and we have a probation officer looking at the kids.
Sorry, can you say what EJJ is?
I'm sorry, extended jurisdiction juvenile. And that's the halfway point between whether a child is straight juvenile, jurisdiction ending at age 19, whether they're certified, which is the other end, going straight into the adult system, or extended jurisdiction juvenile, where they are given an adult prison sentence and a juvenile disposition, and assuming they do the juvenile disposition successfully and are able to maintain through age 21, then they're done. So when you look at some of the factors, here's where some of the issues come into play for us in the defense side. If you look at letter B, culpability. Well, children who have mental health and mental mental health diagnoses, particularly something like FASD, the level of participation in planning, oftentimes these are the kids who are following another group. They have no thought process, nothing stopping them from making that quick decision. But unfortunately, when we're looking at the issues in some of the cases where kids are getting certified, they're serious offenses, and that level of planning doesn't quite get viewed very carefully by the people in the process. The child's prior record of delinquency. A lot of the kids we're dealing with mental health and with mental illness, FASD, are getting in these low-level types of troubles from early on. They are oftentimes the kids who are even in trouble before the age of 10 when they could be facing delinquency charges. And so those factors are used against them when making that decision to place them. The child's programming history. You heard from Referee Carlson, a lot of the kids who are placed in programs are in programs where the staff doesn't necessarily know about FASD or the mental illness or the brain development issues that are there. And so programs are relatively quick to say, you're not a success, you're not going to make it in our program. So again, that can be used against them in making that decision about how they're doing. And the adequacy of programming available in the juvenile justice system. We struggle daily in Hennepin County, and I'm sure elsewhere, with not having services to work with children who have issues regarding developmental delays, who are FASD, or who have mental health problems in connection with other things that they're dealing with. And so kids are pigeonholed in the programs that exist. Those programs don't necessarily work with them very well, and then we are dealing with them on the back end. So if there was anything that we could see, as indicated earlier, is more resources that are where the staff are trained in FASD, and I'm also involved in the task force, and I believe that's something that we're going to get to happen, that the programs who are working with the kids are sensitive to those issues. And we need to have the people who are doing the studies and doing the analysis to begin with knowledge about kids' brain development and what's happening with them. And we need to remember that they're kids, and that they're fully not developed until age 21 to 25 years old. And sending them into a prison system is absolutely the worst thing we can do, because what they're doing is learning new activities, they're making new friends, but we really would prefer that they not be friends with as our members of our society. So if there's anything that we could do to make some of those changes, I'd be very happy to do so. I'm not certain if people have questions or comments. Any questions or comments?
You know, I guess the one thought for me is that, well, first I'll ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Johnson, and that's what the either Hennepin County Public Defenders or the statewide public defenders are doing to assist us in general with mental health in our correctional system, but in particular with our juveniles, and as it relates to pushing out and some solutions that, of course, include prevention, but may have some other ideas that could be helpful for us.
Training, making sure that at least the people we're working with who are aware of kids' issues and developmental issues. I mean, FASD wasn't necessarily on the radar screen for years, although we were probably having kids with FASD going to prison years and years ago and not addressing it, assuming they just had behavioral problems. So education, training, being involved in initiatives such as this one to make sure that the FASD group, to make sure that people are fully aware of what's happening.
My last thought, I'm trying to find a way to say, Representative Tamar, thank you. Actually, I was going to be coming to see you afterwards. I said that you were in finance, and did we finish in finance, finally?
I think they're almost done.
I was just asking Ms. McNaughton for some ideas that the public defenders would be suggesting as it relates to assisting with our juveniles that have been certified, or juveniles that are in the correctional system that have been diagnosed with FASD or some other mental health disorder, and she has suggested some education and that would in training of staff, working with MOFAS, some prevention, and just trying to figure out. It just seems like we're putting more of our kids in prison, unfortunately, and we're not doing, we don't have the money to follow them through the system. So we don't know if you are a 17-year-old and you go to Red Wing, for example, you're not certified, you go to Red Wing, did you get corrected, or did in 3 years you end up at Stillwater? What services are really truly available to help our young people that are diagnosed, let alone those that aren't screened? And so that's the discussion that we are currently having.
I had one additional thought in response to your question, and that is, with a presumptive certification, the best that a child will be able to do, at least best from our perspective, is be on extended jurisdiction juvenile probation up until age 21. In a perfect world, it would be wonderful if the court had the ability during the process to not go back only to extended jurisdiction juvenile status, but all the way to juvenile delinquency status. Because what happens is a child who's placed on extended jurisdiction juvenile status is on very intensive probation up until age 21, and because of the programming issues and because of the lack of knowledge at times of, on some of the program parts, we're getting hearings where the state is seeking to have them placed in prison and revoke their extended jurisdiction juvenile status. And it's very difficult for kids who have mental health issues or FASD diagnoses to make it in some of these programs, and they're on probation for an extent in another couple of years. So if the court at the time all these studies were coming in had the ability to say, you know what, this child is not appropriate for extended jurisdiction juvenile status, I think this child could be treated in the juvenile system and get the help he or she needs at that point. That would be, I think, helpful for at least some of our kids.
Thank you. Representative Madore.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe with Representative Paymar here. We were talking about lowering the certification age to 13, and I'm just wondering, do we know where that bill is? This is the first I've heard of it, and it's very troubling to me to think that that has gone through.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, Representative Madore, the bill has not gone through. It was defeated in the... in the Finance Committee for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah. Thank you, Mrs. Naughton. Most of us are out of water with public safety, and so we're glad Representative Paymar was able to get away from finance, because this isn't our area of expertise, reader, education, or health and human service type folks. So we'll
the
folks that prevent, that are supposed to be preventing this in the first place, Representative Todd.
Well, on that point, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for having this hearing, and I hope that in the future that we try to have some more collaboration between public safety and health and human services in this committee, because we know that our populations, whether they be in our prisons or our jails, are overwhelmingly represented by people with mental health issues, whether they be fetal alcohol syndrome or any other diagnosis. So if we're going to do anything or reform the system or adequately address this issue, we have to have more collaboration. And it's a shame that we don't have that now, but I appreciate the hearing on that, on this, and trying to bridge the divide.
Representative Lilly is here, and we do have staff from public safety that's here, and then Representative Mullery's CA is here. I think it was just that Friday meeting hearing time that just really threw people off, so I really, again, thank you, Representative Haas, and others that, especially that aren't in the metro area, that did make sure that they got here today. But you're right, and we did have some funding to help out in public safety with mental health, that bill that Mindy had last year, and hopefully it's something that we'll make a commitment on in the next couple of years to figure out how to fund some of that moving forward. Ms. Walensky, did I do that one right? Okay. Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to come and share some of my experience. My name is Linda Walensky. I am a registered nurse and a licensed psychologist, and the adoptive mother of five, soon to be six, individuals with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. They are six out of eight in their birth family. So I have at least 8 hours of things to say to you, and that isn't going to happen. But I, as I come here today with decades of experiences with many, many, many children, families, adolescents, emerging adults, and I see harm being done because of lack of understanding, because we do not identify problems correctly, and we throw harmful solutions at people, and overall, what I have seen is that we make it worse, not better. Not on purpose. We haven't been informed. We're about 30 years now into understanding what it is that happens in the brain of a person who's been exposed to alcohol. Real quick, I just want to say that alcohol's poison, called as teratogen. In the developing baby, the amount of brain cells that are supposed to be formed don't get formed because of them being dehydrated by exposure to the alcohol. When the cells are formed in second trimester, they are supposed to migrate so that all the seeing ones get together and work as a team, and all the hearing ones get together and work as a team, and the thinking ones, the emotional regulation ones. But that doesn't happen. The migration doesn't go correctly second trimester when exposed to alcohol. Third trimester, we're supposed to be laying down the insulation around the wiring so that we can have very smooth and rapid transmission of our motor skills. You know, our fear and anger are supposed to tell us if there's danger so that we can take care of ourselves. We're supposed to be able to finally think through what is going on around me, what are the appropriate, or what are all the possible things we could do, and what's the right one, having considered consequences. All that is what happens when we have brains that are functioning correctly, which I'm assuming is true for the people in this room today. Unfortunately, we end up assuming that this is how everybody else's brain is working, and it's not. It's certainly not working in any of those ways for people with who have been exposed to alcohol. They have brain damage. It is a medical, organic diagnosis. Right now it isn't even in the mental health diagnosis book. It's on Axis 3, which is a medical diagnosis, because what we do know is that we have massive neurological problems and brain chemistry problems that are interfering in every way with brain function across the entire spectrum. What we know absolutely in fetal alcohol is that the frontal lobe, where executive functioning comes from, that is defined as our ability to plan and choose our behaviors. That part does not work. We do know that, those of us who kind of know about fetal alcohol, we know all of that. And there is enormous work that's going on to make sure that the community, all of us in a community, raise our children. We're trying to make sure that everybody gets the information, and boy, there's a lot of progress being done. But I will tell you, in my psychology graduate program, we did address fetal alcohol in one class one time for 10 minutes. That's in the early 90s. That's pretty recent. I'm also a nurse. Fortunately, about 5 years ago, in continuing education, we were asked if we wanted to check the box so that we could get a free brochure about fetal alcohol. Well, there's something, you know, that's better than nothing. I get excited about that. The community that is raising these kids, in large part, is schools. We send our kids off to school. Teachers don't know about this. The school counselors and social workers don't know about this. The administrators and the consequence people don't know about this. And even the special education people don't know about this. So there is a model that we have for people whose brains work that we use. It's an EBD model, the emotional behavioral special ed model, which is a consequence model that works for people who don't have brain damage. So you say, here's the rule, here's the consequence. And then we give rewards and stickers and we withdraw, and Do you know that if your brain is working, that is highly effective, and we've known that forever. But that, the application of that model to kids that have anything wrong with their brain, kids with fetal alcohol, autism, bipolar disorder, ADHD, etc., all of those things, causes harm. We create explosive, aggressive, violent actions, and we destroy our children when we do that. There is a lot of work being done to try to educate educators, but it's only just barely begun. And then, you know, these children really do have problems. Their emotional center doesn't work. They have no connection to what is real, what is really going on around them. They don't connect at all. So they really lose it. They have meltdowns. They are in what we would call a psychotic time when they are dangerous, hurting themselves and others. So we send them to the stop and think room. Or we lock them up and we send them to some little correctional camp, and everything gets worse. What I have been watching over decades of time is how our system, in our correctional system, in our social services system, in our educational system, in our medical and psychological system, they blame parents for bad parenting. That is not what's going on. We have children with brains that don't work. But I want to tell you that we already know about some solutions. And so partly I want to talk to you today about what I've had the opportunity to learn, work, things that exist in Minnesota already that we could be accessing, and some what feel like miracle kinds of stories that are happening with my children, all of which could be in corrections right now. So, here's what we need to know. These kids' brains do not work. Unfortunately, it's invisible. There is a document, and I don't know, we had a PowerPoint presentation or something. But anyway, the Minnesota Department of Health put out a little booklet, and I could, you know, send this around the table. 1999, it was published, Fetal Alcohol Syndrome and Fetal Alcohol Effects. And there is a lot of good, very simple, brief information that would be so nice, and this is accessible to all of you and everybody in the state of Minnesota. But there's a chart that has been replicated in everything I've ever read on fetal alcohol. It matches with my own experience, and that is this. Listen to this. When we have an individual who has reached the age of 18, we call them adults, we say they have capacity. We said that because we didn't know any better. I know that the individual who testified before me did say that we do now know that that frontal lobe with executive functioning and planning isn't done being formed until somewhere between 21 and 25 in a healthy brain. Okay, but I'm talking about fetal alcohol right now. So what we know is they're 18 years old, so they get held responsible for their behavior. Their expressive language, which means if you were to listen to them, they talk, they make sentences, and they sound like they know what they're talking about. So if we don't know any better, we could believe that they are thinking and they are choosing and they know what's going on. Okay? They aren't thinking and they aren't choosing. And the worst thing that can happen to them is that people don't understand that, because their comprehension is a six-year-old level. They don't comprehend. Are we going to send six-year-olds in our society to adult prison? We would never think of that, yet that's what we are doing now. Their emotional maturity is that of a six-year-old. Their social skills are that of a seven-year-old. Their living skills overall, food, clothing, shelters, money management, boundaries, 11 years old. Well, we know better. We all know better. They just send their little tiny children into an adult prison with that level of functioning. We would not do that. But see, we don't know that that's what we're doing. As we look at does this person is getting in trouble have capacity? They absolutely don't. But we really need to get better at, one, getting these people, these individual children, adolescents, etc., an adequate assessment. We have those facilities here in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota really knows what they're doing. They know how to do the cognitive testing so that all of us can understand what's really going on with this person. One of my children, 14-year-old son, 6 feet tall, 200 pounds, is developmentally 4 years, 9 months. He doesn't look like he's 4 years, 9 months. Now, lucky for Sean, everybody in his life knows that that's his ability level. So he ends up getting the support that he needs. It helps a lot to get a correct assessment. These individuals deserve to be assessed correctly. They are often dangerous and out of control. Sometimes they do need to be secured. In our home, in one 12-month period, we had 59-1-1 calls, 28 inpatient hospitalizations. The medical bills that arrived in my home were over $1 million in a 12-month period, just three of my children. The cost is enormous. Sean ended up going to Wilmer State Hospital, which saved his life. I want you people to know that we have incredible resources in our state that can be life-saving and can inform all of us about appropriate care. Sean was there for only 4 weeks. Those people are brilliant. They know about everything that's going on in the brain and how to treat it. They explain it to the community. They help make adequate discharge plans so that the environment and what this child needs in their brain is met. We've had no more 911 calls. My kids live at home and they go to school. They go to special school. Brainerd and Wilmer. I've had my own kids there. I have had many of my client children there. They are in hospital. They know about brain disease, mental health. They know what to do. They are life-saving places that don't get access. I would recommend, given the few resources we do have in Minnesota, I would wish for kids that have significant behavior problems right now, they end up in corrections. At least that's the radar screen says, a bad thing happened, that's not okay, we need to intervene. Absolutely, that's correct. I would wish that they would get placed right now at Wilmer or Brainerd, whichever is the appropriate place, so that they could get a good assessment and begin treatment. That would be my hope. There is treatment. Here's what we do know works. These kids do not have a brain that functions on their own. They need a surrogate frontal lobe. That means one of us around with them that does have a brain network that can keep them safe and help make decisions. There is a lot of training about that. There's Ross Green is a Harvard professor that has put together a treatment program called the Collaborative Problem Solving Approach, which is used in many schools that have become enlightened, and it works. There is a behavioral treatment program that has been put together by occupational therapists called the ALERT scale, a 1-5 scale, and it helps kids through sensory ways and in an appropriate environment to stay at a level 3, which is I am calm, I am paying attention, and I can follow directions. The violence stops. There are medications that really can help the biochemical problems of these children that work. Then they get to stay in community, live in family, learn to the very best of their ability, whatever that is, and become productive and have a decent life, which is what we are supposed to be providing to human beings in our state. We have many things that we know already work. The technology is already there. The services already exist. But we need to understand these children are not on purpose choosing to be harmful and destructive. They're out of control. We need to help them with an appropriate environment. Calm, safe, secure interactions, medications, and then the structure that they need so that they can be safe. I just need to add that there are two other things that exist in our state that are incredibly helpful. My son John is sent by our school district 50 miles away from our home every day to go to a very special school. It is called Northeast Metro 916 in White Bear Lake. They are the utopia model. Every book I've ever read about what is appropriate in an educational environment for children whose brains don't work, they know, and they do. Every district needs to have a school exactly like that available for these kids, and then they'll be okay. When they move into adulthood, there is already a place up near Duluth, and I brought my little business card, who I've had some clients who have been able to go there. 18 to 25 years old, they understand fetal alcohol. It's out in the country. It is very, very safe. They treat them appropriately in every way. These kids are able, with that kind of appropriate support and problem solving, to learn some skills and to end up in apartments with jobs with some supervision. There are already many things that we know already work. It's just that the kids that are in trouble, nobody's ever recognized it, and nobody's ever appropriately helped them. And the model we have right now that we use automatically causes harm. These kids never did anything wrong. It wasn't their fault that their brains got destroyed. Any more than people who have diabetes and it gets out of control and they act as if they're drunk and they do bad things. We don't punish them. They have a disease and we get back. People who have seizure disorders and all types of violent hurtful things can happen in the middle of a seizure and in the post-fiscal phase following when they are completely disoriented. We don't throw them in prison. We understand that they have a medical disease and we treat it and they're fine and society is safe. The same thing exists in mental health and in fetal alcohol. We know a lot already. We need that information disseminated and we need the services that we know do work applied to these kids so that we don't throw them away and destroy them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Wardlow. But before you go, Representative Wardlow, unfortunately, the services in Brainerd are coming to an end. Rip. All the Brainerd is closing. Brainerd is closing. What some of the services will be moved to Wilmer, but Brainerd is gone. We've already sold the building. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was one of my questions. That's too bad. You might be one of the best testifiers I've ever heard in 6 years. And if we didn't have this mental health committee, maybe we never would have heard it.
No.
But anyway, a comment was made a while ago by the referee judge about the first 18 hours of pregnancy. Because I think of people I know who went to a party and had 3 or 4 martinis and didn't know they were pregnant. And I just wonder, can you speak to how that affects the brain of the fetus?
Ms. Walensky? There
is no known safe quantity or time of alcohol as far as we know right now. Because the nervous system, which, you know, that's what our brain is developing across the entire time. Within 18 hours.
18 days.
We already have the brain developing. And that would be that first trimester time when we are creating the brain cells at all. So if we are dehydrating the brain cells during that first 18 days, a lot of them aren't even going to get made. And we do see on many brain scans the actual brain organic size, structure, spaces where we're supposed to have neurons connecting. Those changes happen because of what we know is, especially binge drinking, is a major damaging effect.
would it, you know, where's the perfect world? Alcohol is a legal substance. It's not illegal to drink. You know, I'm a mandated reporter, and included in what I have to report is if a woman is pregnant and she is using substances that destroy the fetus, I have to report that. So both the mother and the baby can be healthy. But do you know that alcohol is not on that list? And it is the number one teratogen, and it's lethal. It's just a lethal substance, so it's very, very difficult to intervene. We do have more and more education coming out. And I do remember when Susan Carlson was first lady and the billboards were up, which was like the first recognition that there's a problem with drinking. I became a registered nurse 35 years ago. I studied obstetrics, et cetera. We were taught that it was really much better for the development of the fetus if the mother was relaxed. Mm-hmm. And so it was okay to have couple drinks, glass of wine, etc. Oh, no, it wasn't. So, you know, we need to, so you could say, how do we prevent this, really? We make it illegal for any woman of childbearing age to drink. Because who knows? Who knows?
Miss Willis, you went too far.
I was with you.
That's the moment. I know.
You're the only safety. But it doesn't, you don't even have all the laws that you want. You can even have all the training that you want. And I'll illustrate your question.
My 19-year-old daughter is high-functioning fetal alcohol, such a good girl. And she learned a lot about fetal alcohol. And in all of my children's sixth grade classrooms, when they're beginning to study sex education, life skills, etc., they all had a day on fetal alcohol. My children, in their school, it was there. So they'd come home and they would say, you learned this stuff today. My daughter did a lot of research in fetal alcohol. She wrote papers and presented to her class. She is an incredible artist, and she drew these wonderful pictures of what was happening to the brain and used them at MOFAS, poster programs, etc. But she also had fetal alcohol. So no matter how articulate she might be and how much she would say she was an expert on fetal alcohol and how much she hated that her birth mother drank, therefore she has lots of problems. She ended up through a lot of adolescent kind of problems and things, developing a major depressive disorder, was hospitalized repeatedly, ended up committed to the hospital, and while she was committed, in the custody of the Department of Human Services Commissioner, I thought she was safe, supposed to be locked up, kept safe. She met a 36-year-old mentally ill dangerous man, and she escaped the treatment facility and did marijuana and alcohol and got pregnant and delivered that baby 7 months ago. She was an expert on how damaging alcohol was, and yet she did it too. Because the frontal lobe doesn't work, and we're supposed to be protecting and supervising. And even our state wasn't able to do that.
Representative Tamar?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the witness. If this was already covered, you can just tell me what the Hennepin County initiative. But I'm just curious about if you know whether statewide probation officers in the state of Minnesota get adequate training on fetal alcohol syndrome. I know with their caseloads, and I've seen their PSI reports, that you know there's a limited amount of assessment that they're doing relative to mental health. So I'm just wondering if you know the answer to that.
Representative Tamar, I got this strong no shake from Mrs. Carlson.
Well, it just seems to me if they're not, if, you know, if we're looking for solutions here, it would seem to me probably a maybe not this legislative session, but something we should take up next legislative session to not only require that, but to provide the funding. I mean, if it's undetectable to many of us who might be intervening with young people who are getting in trouble, then we've got a problem.
Yeah.
And so,
what I can tell you is that Susan Carlson and many others put together a manual to train probation officers and everyone who is involved in the criminal justice system. It is an excellent manual. I think it's pretty good at saying what everybody needs to understand so these people would be treated correctly. My private practice in psychology is up in Kennebec County, and I get to collaborate as a team often with the probation officers in my county, and they weren't trained and they did not know. They are open to the training. When I say, here's what's going on, and I loan them my manual, they distribute it among their entire staff because it is so wonderful and helpful, and better decisions can get made. Yes, the training manual already got put together. It exists. But I am so sorry to say, but it appears that in terms of training everybody, the individuals in the juvenile justice system, the probation officers, the teachers, the social workers, the primary care providers and physicians and nurses, and everybody in our profession and our community that's supposed to be helping, there's so many things to know that unless it's mandated education, one, they don't get it, and two, it's not funded through their staff. So the education materials and curriculum have already been developed. And if we could just say, you must read this, or go to this 4-hour class, Lynn Freegard out of Northland, Minnesota, does this incredible 4-hour presentation. The state already funds her training program that she can disperse across the state, I think. Please videotape her presentation and just have everybody watch her videotape presentation. Do you know what a huge difference that would make? She already does the training. It already exists. There's so many things we have that already work. But there's more to it. And it's so wonderful that you are listening.
Now, I want to thank you for your testimony. It's been very informative. Members, bear with us. We do have two more parents. Mr. Farda, if you could identify yourself to the tape and share your testimony.
Hi, my name is Felipe Farda. I'm a parent of a child who is in St. Cloud right now. He had gotten into some trouble. He had just turned 15 years old. And I didn't get him diagnosed with city alcoholism until about 6 months before. And I knew he had problems, but I didn't know exactly what the problems were. He was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 5 and with behavioral problems, and he was had always been into the STEM program and then into the SPAM program. And but there's a just I don't know, there's just a lot of things. I was listening to the people speak, and I heard so many things that sounded familiar to me with my son. He got into a serious problem. He was certified as an adult. Like I said, I had just got him diagnosed over the university with Dr. Kane with fetal alcohol disorder, and I didn't know about it. I knew his mother drank during the pregnancy, during both of his pregnancies. But what happened is with Amani, his problem was that he didn't know how to deal with threats. He had been terrorized from the time he was 11 years old until he was 14 when we moved off their block. And so he was like, it was a psychological thing to him. When he was threatened by somebody, he didn't know what to do. The only thing he knew by the time, because when he was threatened, every time he was threatened, he was beat up afterwards. So it was like a psychological thing to him. And so he just went head on and did what he was told to do rather than because he said getting beat up. But the reason I really came here is because I talked to Neva. I had tried to talk to a few people because the way Hennepin County, even though they did have a program for people with alcohol disorder, it had nothing to do as far as when a child got certified. I think the certification, the judges don't know anything about fetal alcohol disorder. Lawyers don't. The Hennepin County psychologists don't really know about it, because when he was certified as a mental health person to see if he was competent to stand trial, but I asked her, and she admittedly said, "I don't know anything about fetal alcohol disorder." She had really had never heard of it, and so there's so many things that I hear when people testifying, like Monty, for instance. When you ask him questions, he likes to give answers that he believes you want to hear. In other words, he wants to please whoever asking him questions. And the police and the prosecuting attorneys, they wanted to hear the answers that he gave, because those were what they wanted to hear in order to certify him as an adult. And there's so many things that I have found out during this time and even afterwards, where I found out that though Armani had just turned 15, when he was diagnosed, he was actually found to be 3 years behind in his mental development, which meant when he was 14, he actually had the mind of an 11-year-old. You know, and I always knew he acted younger than what he was. He acted younger than his younger brother. But I just thought, well, that's him. But now, you know, hearing his testimony, it was like, all these things, and it's really, to me, it's a nightmare. Because right now, he's in St. Cloud. He has to go back to Charleston on another case. And, you know, I'm trying to get him to understand that if you don't know something, don't say, "I know it," or you answer the question because you think they want to hear. I asked him a question one time, and he told me, "Well, they're looking at me like I'm stupid, and I don't want people to look at me that way, or I'm not crazy." And so he wants to try to just answer questions. And I think one of the things that had really got me was about not just the certification, but when I presented his fetal alcohol disorder to the court, I realized that you had an attorney arguing with the judge. And that particular judge decided that he didn't want to have that in his court. And I feel that it shouldn't be attorneys and judges arguing, because they don't have, their degrees are in law. I felt that they should have had his psychologist come in. His psychologist is Dr. Kang. He's basically the expert person in Minnesota that I know of in that, you know, that type of, I'm trying to think of a word, in with the people who have the alcohol disorder. He has a degree in that. He has a degree in psychology, and he studies, you know, the chemical difference in the brain. And there's just, I don't know, it's just so, it's like a nightmare. It's like something that I've been dealing with the child. I have another son who has fetal alcohol disorder too, in which he is getting help. And I think they're going to send him up to somewhere in St. Cloud to help him deal with his disability. You know, so he can get more tests, so he can be worked with, so he'll know how to deal with situations. Because his thing was, he had gotten involved with some people that taught him how to feel tired. And so that's one of the things I heard today when somebody else was testifying, is that these kids do learn from people, and they can learn, but it's who they want to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the problem is. And I really wish, I know, for instance, Red Wing has a program down there called a peer pressure program that Armani could have been able to go to, but they decided, no, we're not going to let him do that. And that's where I'm at today. But I'm really glad that they had a session today here in the legislature to deal with this problem, because for parents, it's a nightmare when you don't know what to do and there's really nowhere to go for help. When you ask people, they don't know too much about it. And I'm just glad it's starting to come up now.
Thank you for your testimony. See, no questions. Ms. Cotola?
Yes.
I'm doing it today.
You got it right.
Thank you.
My name is Jean Cotola, and I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify on these issues surrounding FASD. I did focus on the juvenile justice system. We would have to order lunch if you wanted me to also talk about the problems that we've had with the social and the educational systems. I am the parent of a child with FASD, and I'm also an advocate both at the state and federal levels and a board member of MOFAS. My husband and I have adopted three children from Russia who have been in our family for the past 9 years. Our 17-year-old son was diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder in 2004. He is highly intelligent, he has no physical characteristics, but he's extremely impulsive and has difficulty with making sound decisions. In fact, the chart that Susan Carlson showed you where children with FASD have difficulties with the mental health issues, with school disruption and crime, he is experiencing all of those, and we are very, very concerned as parents. What I'm about to share with you are very personal situations that have happened to our family with the juvenile justice system within this past year. And I wanted to do that because I feel that it's necessary for all of you to really understand the real issues that parents are facing. And I also had provided you with a handout of suggestions, recommendations. Some of these are based on federal legislation that is soon to be passed. We are hoping this summer. And I don't know if we'll have time to review those, but I certainly wanted you to have those in your hands. Our son was arrested in November 2006 for theft and assault. While this was his first offense, his behaviors had been escalating over the course of the past 3 years, and despite the multiple interventions that we have attempted, they kept on continuing. The worst call any parent can make is to have your own child arrested. On the day this took place, we were told that the only thing that placed our son into juvenile detention was the assault. Never mind that he stole over $1,000 in property and stole my car and was an unlicensed driver. It was explained that if the theft was his only crime, he would have been released back into my custody the same day. We were traumatized as a family and had to insist that he not be in our home until we could have some space to process what had happened and felt safe as a family. Incidentally, the police did not believe he acted alone due to the elaborate scheme that he had concocted. My son is considered high risk for being influenced by peers, making him vulnerable, which is a common trait of those with FASD. Kids with FASD often develop friendships with anyone who pays attention to them and will be willing to do anything to maintain those friendships. He also stated at the time that the reason he committed the theft was to regain $50 that was stolen from him several weeks before, which gives way to another common trait, and that is the lack of cause and effect thinking, which can lead to conduct-type problems. We went to court, and because I was the assault victim, I was assigned an advocate. The advocate was clearly distressed after a conversation with a public defender who stated he didn't need to represent our son because our income level was too high, and we could hire our own attorney. However, the advocate indicated, because this was a domestic assault, usually the stipulation was waived. Once in the courtroom, the public defender bickered about the fact that he didn't need to represent our son. The judge and the PD established a new court date, adjourned court, and my son was sent to St. Joe's shelter. As our son was escorted out of the courtroom, we did not quite understand that nothing had been achieved, and his hearing was now pushed out another 2 weeks. We now had to scramble to find an attorney who could represent him. After the next hearing, an investigator interviewed him and our family. I had prepared information to assist the courts emphasizing his FASD diagnosis. I had conveyed to the investigator that while we wanted our son to be held accountable for his actions, we also wanted to ensure that he received structured therapeutic care in order to address his issues and prevent future missteps with the law. Unfortunately, after the interviews and a board review, the investigator on the case recommended he should return home and attend anger management classes. Unfortunately, cognitive-based approaches like anger management have no impact on individuals with fetal alcohol due to the lack of executive functioning of the brain. I told her this would not work, and she became angry with me for challenging this decision.
She said that no one is ever placed in residential treatment for assault on a first offense. Several days later, she changed her recommendations because through the court process, she claimed the prosecutor's office had not forwarded all of my son's charges. She had based her decision on the assault charge and had not included the theft. By this time, my son had spent almost 2 months in St. Joe's shelter. Her final recommendation led us to a court-ordered residential treatment facility for therapeutic care. I was immediately concerned if this place was experienced in working with FASD kids, and the facility assured me that they were. However, after about a month from the time that he was admitted, we discovered that this was a corrections-based facility. Unfortunately, as you've heard this morning, consequence-based models require the ability to remember multiple rules, which doesn't work for those who have FASD, and my son cannot remember all of the rules. He also has difficulty with abstract concepts like time and could not finish the tasks as expected. He would say to me, "Mom, I'll really try harder next time." This inability caused him to lose points that jeopardized his chance at home visits, increasing his frustration and anxiety. Frustration and anxiety are common behaviors for those with FASD, and the situation only intensified what he normally felt every day. Another thing that occurred was that the psychiatrist of the facility diagnosed my son with conduct disorder and antisocial behavior disorder and had ignored my son's 25-page report from the University of Minnesota that cited his FASD diagnosis. During the four-month battle with the facility on their approach with our son, he was exposed to gang members and attacked by his roommates. Because FASD kids mimic and model behaviors, we spent the next 8 months deprogramming him from believing he too was a gang member. After an exhaustive search, I made the discovery that there are no treatment facilities in Minnesota for kids with FASD. There are facilities for 18 and older, but not for kids. In my opinion, by placing our son in a consequence-based program, we increase the risk of him adopting future criminal behavior. We finally had him released through the courts with a court order and probation. On his first stumble with adhering to the court order, the probation officer did not seem knowledgeable in how to enforce it. We were told to call the police. However, the police told us that the probation officer must be contacted first. As parents, we had exhausted every parenting technique, and one of the things that we were expecting was support from an outside authority to help reset his thinking and reinforce expectations. Individuals with FASD need immediate correction for their actions as they are unable to retrieve information later to connect the dots as to why they are receiving a consequence. However, every time he violated his probation, nothing was done to enforce it. We began to wonder the purpose of this document. One of the stipulations of the court order was to attend school. Again, when he refused to attend, even though the school levied consequences, no action was taken, and after weeks of non-attendance and multiple pleas with probation, I started to see a kid sliding through the cracks. We had no leverage and no one to support us. We had already learned that unless he committed a serious crime or was a repeat offender, we could expect no action. In terms of his truancy, it was suggested that we call the police, which we did. Sometimes this worked and other times it didn't, depending on the officer. Some officers didn't blink an eye at taking him to school. However, sometimes we endured the criticism of others. I had one officer who told my son that his own 4-year-old child had better impulse control. What a tragic thing to say to someone who is brain damaged. That would be like criticizing someone in a wheelchair because they can't walk. I had other officers who proceeded to point their fingers and lecture me on what I needed to do differently as a parent. This was exasperating as we had 4 pages of strategies we had tried with our son. On one occasion, I finally asked the officer to leave my home as his approach was anything but helpful. I have told law officials that my son has FASD. However, I receive rolled eyes like I'm making excuses. I am not making excuses, but rather offering an explanation. I'm not expecting anyone to immediately arrest my son. I'm asking for crisis intervention to calm the situation or demonstrate to my son that there are rules in society that must be followed. FASD individuals often need things repeated multiple times in order for them to understand. Unfortunately, because his court order was so ignored, his perception is that he really doesn't have to be accountable. After 1 year of stressful phone calls and meetings, I am finally being told that the reason probation has not acted on his truancy is because there is no truant program due to budget cuts. Unfortunately, when juveniles are in trouble, we have a system that waits until they threaten society rather than a system that prevents problems. In my research, I have found that preventing truancy is a first-line defense to inhibit future criminal behavior. It makes me wonder how many kids who committed serious crimes could have been averted if there was a structured truancy program to get them back on track. In closing, I would like to say that I truly believe that solving problems in the juvenile justice system will require collaboration with parents and the social and education systems. We need to get away from reactive approaches and think prevention. With at least 50,000 individuals in Minnesota with this diagnosis, we either pay now or we will be forced to pay later. Thank you, and I'll take questions.
Members, are there any questions? I want to thank you. That was very informative, and I do. It's just, which doesn't happen often. just thank you. I'm actually going to ask the department, because I see her up there, not for testimony, but for some follow-up for us, because we didn't have the department come up and testify. But she has been here for the entire hearing, and interested on what services are really being available, preventative intervention, how the crisis intervention dollars have played a part, if any, and any other things that may be in the works that the department is assisting our counties on doing, would, I think, be very helpful with trying to figure out what we should be doing with FASD in the next few years. Representative Ruud, we are going to do your motion from earlier. Representative Ruud moves the minutes from March 7th. All those in agreement, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, we will have a couple more hearings, like I said. Hopefully we will be able to do the one on the 30th as long as the leadership does not decide to have us in session too long, or members don't decide to have long speeches. whichever will happen that will assist us. And those of you that had an opportunity to see my going away article in Session Weekly, I have to take a personal moment because my Kenny is here. My best friend has who works on FASD also, along with some other early intervention work with ARC, has my Kenny here, so I just had to recognize him. So thank you.
Yes, Kenny.
Thank you, members. Meeting's adjourned.